hailing frequencies are open. Welcome to the Infinite Potato Alliance.
Hey everyone, if you're a regular listener to our shows or if this is the first time that you've ever stumbled across the site, then you should know that the party continues over at patreon.com/infinitepotato. There's a lot of reasons for you to become a patron. Your donation helps us to pay for things like microphones, hosting services, streaming platforms. You can be a patron for as little as $3 a month, and you get a lot of perks, like early access to episodes and our monthly special episodes where we watch and review some great old movies like Kingdom of the Spiders. Things are starting to move. You think something's about to happen between them, and all of a sudden Shatner says, "You know what I want to do? I want to go burn that spider hill right now." Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Jim never has a second cup of coffee at home.
And The Thing with Two Heads.
That is the show. Okay. The lieutenant.
Well, hey, I want to hear how racist this is.
Okay. And for just a couple dollars more every month, you can become a producer of the network. You'll get a public thank you on some of the episodes. Special thanks to Tom Corcoran, Bulent Bingal, Jeff Hughes, and Brandon Ushio for bringing you this episode of the podcast this week. Find out more by visiting us over at patreon.com/infinitepotato.
Welcome to That Star Trek Podcast.
I am the Guardian of Forever.
This is your place for detailed analysis and speculation of all things Trek.
Double dumbass on you!
Join us as we dive into the newest content coming available, as well as retrospectives of the past series and films.
All out to ship!
Now, on with the show.
I'll see you in 500 years,
and I'll see you in a few
minutes. Hello, everyone, and welcome to an all-new episode of That Star Trek Podcast, your place for a detailed analysis and speculation of all things Trek. My name is Sean Ray, and I think that if Data and Picard hadn't saved the day in Genesis, Data would eventually have turned into a Commodore 64. Joining me tonight in the historic Infinite Potato Studios, we have Rick. How's it going, sir?
To shock me.
And Scott is here as well. How you doing, sir?
Something Kalis.
All right. This week, we are continuing our retrospective of Star Trek's time travel episodes, where we watch all of the episodes that use time travel as a major plot point. This week, we're talking about Season 7 of Star Trek The Next Generation, Episode 21, which was titled Firstborn, written by Mark Caulfield and directed by Jonathan West. The original air date was April 23rd, 1994. In an effort to help him accept his Klingon heritage, Worf and his son, Alexander, attend an ancient Klingon ceremony. That's the only description they put in there. That's a description of the first 10 minutes of the episode.
Well, one, it's not an ancient Klingon ceremony. It's the Klingon equivalent of a Renaissance fair.
Yeah, and pretty two, much. It's a festival.
That's Act 1.
Yeah, and John just commented, my favorite part was the Klingon Rocky Horror Picture Show. All right, so let's do our initial thoughts. Rick, what did you think of this episode?
Oh, I hate this episode so much. I watched it at 1.5 times speed just to get through the damn thing, because I haven't seen it in years, and even that hurt. Oh, this is such a bad episode, and I'm not even going to pull a single goddamn punch on this one. Not even James Sloyan can save this cinematic piece of patak poop.
All right. Scott, what about you? What do you think?
This is all right. Well, I don't know. I don't think it's necessarily all right. I don't love this episode either. It's... As we get further into TNG, especially into season 6 and 7, if I'm doing a rewatch from beginning to end, This is one of the episodes that I will usually feel okay skipping over. Of course, top of the list being Rascals. Hashtag Rascals sucks. There are things to like about it. Sloyan is always fun to watch, but there's also, you know, parts of this episode that I don't really enjoy. I don't like the idea of Kimtar, a very convenient yet never mentioned family friend who somehow actually existed and is now fake. Was it Alexander all along? Was this really a long con where he spent years as the actual Kimtar so he could come back and be Kimtar again? Or is he just becoming someone, hey, you remember me? Yeah, I do. Well, thank God for that, or else this plan would not have worked. So that doesn't necessarily track. And then if you remember what this episode does to, I can't remember which one of the Duras sisters it was. I think it was Lursa.
Betor.
Was it Betor? Okay.
Pregnant?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they say that Betor is pregnant. They show up again in Generations.
Generations, yeah.
And then they meet their end in DS9 shortly thereafter. But then that reminds us, they're seen in DS9, and then they meet their end in Generations.
Yeah.
And when that happens, if we remember this episode, we're like, oh, so they orphaned a Klingon baby. That was not nice of Riker to do that. But of course, they're not going to mention that because, you know, they just use her to be pregnant for this one plot point, and then it's never brought up again.
Because we don't know what happened. She may not have ever had the baby, or I don't know what the gestation period for a Klingon is.
Well, and that makes it
worse. Why are you saying that she was pregnant in Generations?
I don't know.
When they blew up their ship? That's way worse.
But and that, you know, just adding insult to injury, that whole Lursa and Betor plotline, they just drop it as soon as Worf finds out who Kimtar really is.
Yeah.
And there's no resolution to it. No, gee, we're sorry, or this was a setup. It was just like, yeah, that didn't happen. We're just going to ignore it. This thing was so...
Yeah, the only reason that they were there was for the drop of there's something on this knife that shows my son, and I don't have a son yet. I'm pregnant, and to lead into the fact that Worf figures out that this is somebody from another time or whatever.
This knife is from the future.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so my initial thoughts are this is kind of a run of the mill episode for me. It's not a great episode, but I mean, it's not the worst episode of the series. I'm not crazy about the Klingon Central episodes for the most part. Some of them are better than others. I think Deep Space Nine had some better ones than TNG did. I think that Worf is a better character on Deep Space Nine than he is on TNG.
100%. Just because
I don't think they did much with him. Like I was saying in the last episode, it seems like there are more Worf episodes in the last two seasons than there were in the entire first five seasons. Because they just suddenly remembered that he's there.
They remembered that they could do something other than Worf say line, someone else say no.
Yeah. Yeah, well, some of the time travel episodes that we've already covered, Worf's barely in them. Because you can't really take Worf to another time.
he's not a merry man.
Yeah, and have him kind of blend in. They used the last couple of seasons to kind of give us a bunch of Worf episodes and have it be about how he's this helicopter parent for Alexander because he is on Alexander's ass all the time. I don't think we've talked a lot about Alexander on the show, so there's a lot of jokes about Alexander's age, but I've always thought of it like, you know, Klingons just grow faster than humans, at least until they get to adulthood. And then, wait a minute, John just commented. So,
it's got a couple, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was boring up until he went to the room to talk to Alexander. Then it was mildly interesting. Then it was boring again for quite some time. I figured Kimtar was a real person, and he just pretended to be him. And then he also said, as mentioned, I don't remember most of these episodes. It was like 30 minutes in, and I was like, this is a time travel thing? Was this supposed to be under the character crossover series? No, we didn't do it in the character crossover series because Quark's appearance on the show is not central to the plot. Like I was saying, Klingons age faster than humans until they reach adulthood. That's always been my theory or whatever, why we see Alexander growing so rapidly, because he's conceived at the end of season 2. The next time we see him is in season 4, and he's already like, he looks like he's 5 years old. And then he grows pretty rapidly until we see him in Deep Space 9, and he looks like he's a grown man. And he's only like 8.
And old enough to join the Klingon Defense Forces.
Right. Yeah, so he was played in season 4. Four, no, yeah, he was playing season 4 by John Stewart, who we know tragically committed suicide a few years ago. He was recast in, well, I mean, he wasn't recast because of that. I mean, obviously, this was a long time ago. He was recast in season 5 by Brian Bonzal, who plays him in this episode. And he's also, if you ever watched the sitcom Family Ties, he played little Andy Keaton. On Family Ties. If you want to see him without all the Klingon makeup, go watch a later season episode of Family Ties, and you'll see him.
That's one of the things that I wonder about when I see Brian Bonsall playing Alexander. Is that considered brownface?
The pigmentation on Klingons from TOS through Enterprise has been problematic. You know, I don't know that I'm really qualified to say. You know, a lot of people consider it, yes, to be brown face, black face,
inappropriate.
Yeah.
I'm not qualified to say either, but I will say that when they have a Klingon played by an African American, I always think that it looks better.
Yeah.
I always think that the makeup looks better on them than it does when they try to take a white person and darken them to match something else.
Mm-hmm. I think it's less problematic in the later, you know, in the TNG onward Klingons than what they did for in TOS with trying to make them very clearly to be, you know, the evil Asian character that was the big trope in the 60s.
Yeah.
And I think it was a lot more blatant then, but again, like I said, I'm not really the right person.
It was big in the 60s, and then George Lucas kept it going into the 90s.
Oh, yeah.
I remember watching episode 1 in the theater, and I was like, is it okay that he's doing that, they're doing that?
You know, it was bad.
And of course, we see him played in Deep Space Nine by Mark Warden. He's as a teenager, even though, as I said, he's only supposed to be 8 or 9 at that point, but he's obviously like an 18-year-old guy. So anyway, Worf is concerned that his son Alexander is not pursuing his Klingon heritage, and he has no desire to become a Klingon warrior. Captain Picard recommends that Worf should expose Alexander to more of his heritage at the Cote Beauvoir Festival at Moringa 4. Moringa does not sound like a Klingon word. Is that a Klingon? I mean, it says it's Klingon outpost. So I guess it's not a Klingon planet, but
anyway. Yeah, they can have outposts wherever they want. I considered it whatever planet this is. It's like Klingon town.
Yeah, I understand. John says Picard is woke. Hashtag Picard is woke. John says, I guess I'm qualified. I'm sure I noticed the Klingon thing, but I don't remember caring.
Okay. I'm going to put out an opinion on this and just take it for what it's worth. I think people are getting more hung up on the mechanics rather than the context. You know, if, you know, a certain non-human race, you know, has a different skin color, then you use that makeup. You know, like, no one complains about the Andorians being blue. You know, I don't think that the Klingons, you know, having a consistent skin tone, no matter who's playing them, I don't think that's necessarily problematic. It's because it's a different race. That's a non-human race. It's a makeup look, as opposed to, you know, someone doing who was that dude that's did Mammy? What can't remember his name now. The minstrel guy back in the '40s that did the first talking movie.
Oh yeah, well, there's a lot of them. Yeah,
Jolson,
Al Jolson. You know, yeah. That kind of shit is. That's a big, hard, absolutely n effing way. No,
I was thinking more Fletcher Stevens from Short Circuit.
Yeah, well, that's because they're actually trying to parody not just a race, but like the culture. They're trying to impersonate the entire culture and everything. And the thing with the Klingons is that they all look the same, which is a strength and a weakness, I guess, because they all look the same. But they all look the same. It doesn't really matter if you've got 15 Klingons lined up. It doesn't really matter who the actors are in the costume. They're just supposed to be a Klingon. Now, right. you got the Klingons with the speaking roles and stuff like that, the close-ups and all that. But I mean, I'm not going to say that anybody shouldn't be offended by it, because I can't tell somebody what to be offended by and what not to be offended by.
Yeah.
But they're not making a parody of black culture by doing this. This is a culture that they're creating as an alien race, you know. So obviously, we don't want all the aliens to look just like us, you know. But then, like I said, you know, all the Klingons look the same. All the Cardassians look the same. All the Romulans look the same. They all wear the same clothes. They all do their hair the same way. okay, so Worf takes Alexander to the festival, and it appears to kind of help Alexander become interested in the Klingon way of life. When the two of them are suddenly attacked by a trio of Klingon warriors, another Klingon arrives and helps them fight off the trio. Before we get into that, I wanted to talk about this action, the little play that they were watching, which was Kalis fighting some other Klingon. Yeah.
Molar.
And Alexander gets up there and fights with him. Like, did nobody tell Alexander he wasn't actually supposed to hit anybody with that bat lift? Because everybody's like, they're holding their bat lift up and they're stopping just an inch or so away from each other. Well, Alexander just ching, 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 and knocks him down and hits him with it. And I was like, did he just stab him with that thing?
And no, nobody told him not to do
that. Yeah, they didn't tell him to do. Hey, don't go out there and kill that man. He's just an actor. He's just pretending, you know. I like when Worf was kind of getting irritated because the other members of the Enterprise crew were there and they were asking a lot of questions and stuff. Crusher was there asking questions. No. Yes. Stop talking. And
I'm trying to watch the show.
The thing that I laughed out loud because Geordi comes up and asks Worf a question. And Worf answers the question and then just casually holds out the bag of worms that he's eating out of. And the look on Geordi's face when he looks down at it and then he looks at Worf like, you really expect me to eat that?
That is one of the moments of the episode that I like. It not just the, you know, the offering gawk to Geordi.
Yeah.
And which, I don't know, seems a little bit dickish of Geordi. I mean, Geordi's one who's like, no, trust me. This pasta is great. You're going to love it. Here, have this pasta. But then Worf is like, here, you're going to love this gawk. It's great. This is traditional street food at this festival. And he's like, the hell are you? What?
I'm not eating worms.
I was wondering what they were using for the worms, because Alexander was sucking those down like crazy. It was great.
Yeah. It's probably, if I had to guess, it's spaghetti. Like, really, like, overdone spaghetti so that it's kind of stringy, you know.
Mm-hmm. There's another type of, I don't know why I'm going up on the name of it. It's a similar but thicker strand pasta than spaghetti.
Linguine?
probably that's probably what I'm thinking of. Is either that or you know, they might have gotten some warm and maybe slightly wet gummy worms.
Yeah, probably one of the easier gummy worms, but they were too limp.
Yeah, if I had to guess, and we're going way into the weeds over what they were eating, but when you cook spaghetti, if you cook spaghetti in the sauce, and then you take the leftovers and put them in the refrigerator, the next day the spaghetti kind of has the consistency of what they were holding up. So it could have been cold day old spaghetti, which would be easy and cheap, you know, to get.
If not the most funny.
A couple of things about this scene.
Yeah, John says that Alexander was not very bright in that scene, and it also reinforces that he's unfamiliar with the traditions of his culture. Yeah.
I think he goes out there, he's like, Dad's always wanting me to kick people's ass, so wait, you didn't want me to this time?
And, I mean, Rick, you're familiar with how Renaissance fairs work. You think there's never been a kid at a Renaissance fair who's thought, oh, I'm gonna fight this knight.
I've been on the receiving end of that. Back when I did the SCA, the medieval reenactment stuff, if we were doing a demo like out in a park or a library or something, and there were a lot of kids, what we would do is often like one of us fighters would let the kids take a shot at us. You know, we'd just put our, you know, just hit the shield. Mm-hmm. And a lot, you know, most of the kids would just kind of go tap. They'd be kind of timid and go tap, tap. And then every now and then you'd get that one kid who's like, I'm going to knock your ass out. And they would just baseball swing right. And yeah, like, you have to pretend it's not that big a deal, but your whole forearm is going, ow.
Yeah, yeah. And also, this is way off the topic, but I want to say it before I forget. But episode 2 of Loki, when they went to that Renaissance festival, and it said down at the bottom of the screen that it was in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. This is not a spoiler. There's a Renaissance festival in episode 2, and at the bottom of the screen it comes up, it says Oshkosh, Wisconsin. That Renaissance festival is the Renaissance festival in Georgia, because they film all that stuff in Georgia, and mm-hmm. I've been to that Renaissance festival, and it's really cool, but it's expensive. It's expensive to get in, and then everything that you do costs money.
Oh yeah. My biggest problem with, I mean, we go to the Ren Fair here every year. Well, every year that it's happening and safe, we didn't go this day. Anyway. My big gripe with Ren Fairs is that if they could charge you for every breath you take when you're in there,
yeah,
they would.
Yeah.
Yep.
Now I dig that that's how they make their living, and you know, they're kind of nomadic and they only make money when they're at the fair, but still.
Well, it was also kind of cool because there was a girl there that I don't remember her name now, but she did a routine. It was one of those like scarf routines where they're hoisting themselves up in the air and dancing in the air with the scarves mm-hmm. and stuff like that. And we saw her there. We met her. My daughter went up and talked to her and stuff like that. This is several years ago. My daughter was probably 7 or 8 at the time. And then that fall, she was on America's Got Talent. she made it to the next round, but she didn't go to the next round because it would mean missing the Renaissance Festival, which is where she makes her living. So she couldn't, mm-hmm. she couldn't do it. So
I've probably seen her too.
I've got a picture of her somewhere on Facebook. I'll find it.
Kind of like 40-ish.
No, maybe. She was really young. She was in her
20s. Really? Oh, okay.
Yeah, she was in her 20s, and she was very petite, very tiny.
Oh, very okay. Tiny this person. Isn't the same yeah. one,
though. Okay. So, he introduces himself, the stranger introduces himself as Kimtar, a Gentok, or an advisor to the House of Moog, who has come to protect Worf. Kimtar joins Worf and Alexander as they return to the Enterprise while the crew investigates the attack. And Kimtar, and for some reason, is really rude to Commander Riker. and to the point that Worf has to ask him, is like, why are you being such a
wait a minute. Riker? We didn't talk about the attack.
Yeah, they were attacked by and another Klingon shows up and they fight off the trio. I said that, and then we started talking about Renaissance festivals.
Oh, okay. because there's something I wanted to bring up because now if anyone listening out there, have we got anyone watching?
John's watching right now.
anyone that speaks Klingon, because this did bother me. Thank you, John. I don't speak a lot of Klingon, but I do, especially most of Christopher Lloyd's lines from Star Trek III, because I really enjoy his performance as Krug, and his pronunciation of Klingon phrases. And I remember a lot of them. And at the point where he tells his men on the planet to kill one of the prisoners, because Kirk's not complying as quickly as he wants.
Yeah.
And he says, kill one of them. I don't care which. And the phrase that was translated as I don't care which was T'Shakhpe. And that's what the Klingon that attacked Worf said just before he attacked Worf.
He said, I don't care which.
Yeah. It's a Klingon phrase, but it doesn't mean anything in that context.
Yeah, they've always claimed, because they did come out with that Klingon dictionary back in the 90s where you're supposed to be able to learn the language or whatever. I've always wondered how much they actually stuck to that, because I think they make up Klingon words all the time.
Well, they have to, because the vocabulary has to grow each time. But, you know, Mark Okrand, who created the Klingon language, you know, he there was a certain, you know, there's a limited vocabulary of just, you know, kind of the stuff they needed for each instance. But he created a whole grammar for the language. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's not like, you know, most of your science fiction languages are just, here's a bunch of words from, you know, Mimbari. And we're not going to sweat context or syntax or anything like that, because how often are they going to say it? So we just need a few words. But Okrand created the Klingon language. He established a language. And so while the words grow with every movie and, you know, and TV show iteration, the structure of the language remains the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember seeing an interview, I think it was when Star Trek VI came out, because they were talking about the scene where they start quoting Shakespeare, and they're quoting Shakespeare in Klingon, and it said it was really difficult, that scene, because there's no Klingon phrase for to be.
Yeah.
And when I saw that, I was like, there wasn't a Klingon phrase for anything. You made the whole thing up. All right, so
John addressed
hashtag alien slang. Well, it was a fake attack, so maybe it was some paraphrasing of "go for it." It doesn't really matter. I don't care which. All right, so with Worf's approval, Kemptar tries to train Alexander in the ways of the Klingon warrior, but this proves ineffective. Kemptar recommends that Worf send Alexander to a Klingon military academy, which would be harsh on Alexander, but effective. Worf balks at the idea, and Kemptar threatens to invoke Klingon law, and take custody of Alexander from Worf. When Kemptar pressures Alexander to join the academy, the boy refuses. I mean, I don't know a whole lot about Klingon law, but if there's a law there that says I don't agree with what this guy's doing with his son, so I want to take his son away from him, that's not a good law.
Well, keep in mind, it's not so much I don't agree with how this father is raising his son. This is, you know, Klingon law in Klingon culture, and he's essentially saying we're running the risk of this child growing up to be a pansy. So
yeah,
you know, everything is on the table as far as preventing that from happening.
Right.
Well, and I think Worf would not sit still for it.
No. So. Not at all. I don't. Yeah.
He would lose his Old West deputy if that happened, and that's not that's not okay.
So the Enterprise crew examines one of the daggers used during the attack on Worf and Alexander, and it bears the markings of the Duras sisters. Commander Riker gets intelligence from Quark at Deep Space Nine that helps him locate the Duras sisters and accuses them of the assassination attempt. The sisters deny any involvement. When Worf presents the dagger, they recognize one marking as belonging to Lursa's son, despite the fact that she has only just learned that she has become pregnant.
So I was wrong. It wasn't Bator. It was Lursa.
The Quark appearance. I mean, it was a good scene. I liked it. This was early in the days of Deep Space Nine. This would have been season two of Deep Space Nine. And what season was it when Bashir was on Next Generation, when Data was having dreams? Was that season seven season as seven. Well?
Yeah.
So they were really trying to use Next Gen to bring in the viewers for Deep Space Nine for that second season.
I thought that more and stronger crossovers would have worked. I would have had no problem with that. The part one of Birthright was where the Enterprise went to DS9 and we saw Bashir and Worf and Geordi are on the promenade having lunch. We see Picard and Beverly on the promenade briefly. But that was Next Gen using DS9 as set dressing for a few scenes and borrowing an actor for the B plot. And that was it. But an actual for real crossover that had part one on one series and part two on the other series, I would have been on board for 100%. And I consider that a missed opportunity. The same with DS9 and Voyager. It would have been a lot harder to make that fly because of their locations in the galaxy. But if they had found a way to link the series with a two-part episode that jumps from one series to the other, I thought that would have been great. I would have been so excited for that. I wish they had tried harder to do more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's kind of become the norm these days when you have two or three shows that take place in the same universe to at least have one episode a year where they kind of come together. They used to do it, I know this is a bad example, but like on Hercules and Xena and all that, there was always one episode every season where Hercules and Xena were together, you know, and had an adventure together or something like that. And of course they do it with the DC, but the DC shows are a little different, doing the big crossover every year, and that just gets bigger and bigger until it eventually implodes itself.
Yeah, Crisis on Earth X, Elseworlds, and then of course you get Crisis on Infinite Earths, which, that was. I'm not going to say it was bad.
I said the CW does it and they suck now. Superman and Lois is on the CW, and that Superman is a good and Lois show.
They are hitting the mark with that show for sure. And that shows where they're putting their focus and their money, because I mean, I'm essentially hate watching The Flash at this point.
I haven't watched The Flash in two seasons.
And kind of the same with Legends of Tomorrow. I'm not loving it. I tapped out of Batwoman. I think I made it into two episodes into the second season, and I haven't watched it since then.
I haven't seen any Batwoman except for when she was on the crossover. And not because I just don't want to watch it. I just haven't invested in it to know that I'm going to watch this entire series or whatever. So,
Well, also, a more practical reason why there wasn't more crossover between TNG and DS9 is that TNG had a petty dictator running it and didn't like that DS9 was being popular, and he wasn't.
Was he not involved in DS9? I kind of
very little.
In my head, I assumed that he was just kind of working on all the series as they had.
Yeah, I thought he was big in Deep Space Nine because he's the reason that Terry Farrell left the show.
He was, but I mean, he was the executive producer, but especially once Voyager started getting done, he focused more on Voyager. One of the reasons Deep Space Nine got away with so much non-Trek-ish, non-Roddenberry-ish stuff is because Berman didn't like the show, resented the show, and really tried to do as little as possible with it, unless it was something like, being a petty bitch to Terry Farrell or stuff like that.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about Berman, in case
Rick Berman.
In case no one can tell, which should be pretty obvious, because what other Star Trek producer are we going to talk about in such glowing terms?
Most of the actors have had a story about. I mean, listen to Denise Crosby talk about him, or listen to Will Wheaton talk about him. They've all got stories about what he did to them and things. So.
And speaking of Wheaton, Rick, I have spent the last like 4 days binging every episode that's been released so far of Investigates. And
aren't
you're
they
right.
Awesome?
Yeah, they're really good.
I have listened up to Brent Spiner, I think.
You've got to listen to Nana's interview.
I'll get to it.
Real gut punch. I had no idea what happened to her.
Yeah, neither did I. I listened to part one of that and oh.
Yeah. But it's incredible. And Gates McFadden is so good at making it, just talking to you know. It's like if you ever heard David Tennant's
podcast.
He and Gates are very similar in that they have a lot of friends that we would want to hear them talk to, and they have a really nice conversational, it's not all about me way of talking to their friends, and it's they're just really great shows.
Yeah. All right. Back to this episode.
back to our show.
So Worf then finds Kimtar about to kill a sleeping Alexander and immobilizes him. Kimtar is forced to reveal that he is really Alexander from several decades in the future, having traveled back in time to prepare his younger self for an assassination attempt on his father. He had arranged the attack on Marenga 4 to trigger a desire to protect Worf, and had hoped to direct the young Alexander to take the warrior's path so as to prevent Worf's assassination later. Worf tells Kimtar that he could only die happy knowing that Alexander followed the course that he wanted to take in life. And so with Worf's resolve and newfound appreciation for his son's interest, Kimtar is satisfied and returns to his own time. Kimtar travels back in time to try and get his younger self to take this path. But if his younger self had taken a path, then that version of Kimtar wouldn't exist anymore. So you get this whole... It would branch off into a whole alternate reality anyway, you know.
Yeah, and this once again goes into the temporal mechanics of a Star Trek story, which doesn't matter.
How do you time travel? I know a guy. Wait a minute, John wrote, I missed this one. I don't really understand Kimtar's plan. With the gun.
Here with the gun. He corrected it right afterward. He said here.
Oh, okay. What's he talking about? I missed something. What's he talking about?
Why was Kimtar going to kill Alexander?
Why was he going to kill his younger self when he said, oh, I didn't turn my younger self into a warrior. I should turn my younger self into dust.
Yeah, that doesn't really make any sense. Because then you don't exist. Well, if you're going like back to the future theory, then you don't exist anymore if you do that. If you go Star Trek 09 theory, you're part of an alternate reality anyway, so it doesn't matter what you do in the past.
Well, his plan, here it is for John. His plan, when he realized I failed to turn my younger self into a warrior, so if I kill my younger self, then I won't be around to promote my message of peace in the future, which will lead to Worf dying. If I kill myself, then my peace-loving ways won't cause my father's death in the future. My father's life is more important than my own. How you doing, Jake Sisko?
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, yeah, I understand that.
Yeah, I forgot about that part, yeah.
Yeah, because otherwise, killing a child, there's no honor in killing a child. He should turn the sword on himself, or I don't know.
No, John has a good point, because his next comment is, wouldn't a more effective means to just be, I'm from the future, listen to what I have to say? And yes, he's absolutely right. If you're going to time travel, then just say, hey, I'm a time traveler. This is what's going to happen. So you know, maybe try your best to make me into a tough guy instead of a pacifist. It's like, peace out. I'm going back to the future.
I've come back here to change time, but I don't want to change things, so I'm going to be sneaky about it.
Which also, like you were saying in the beginning, Scott, it makes you wonder how long ago Alexander traveled from the future, because it says he's from several decades. But if he's a family friend that Worf has known, I'm assuming his whole life, that would be several decades. So that would mean that he traveled from not too far in the future and grew older in the past, right?
Worf wouldn't know a family friend all his life.
Well, yeah, that's true.
Not on Kronos.
Yeah, this was a friend of his brother. This was a friend of Kern's, I guess.
Or he's claiming to be a friend of Kern's.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Which, and that also seems odd, because wouldn't one of the first things that Worf does be to, you know, get on the subspace and say, "Hey, Kern, you remember Kimtar? Well, he's here. Have you seen this guy lately?
But I killed him last week.
I haven't seen him for 30 years.
Kimtar has been dead." I can't do a Tony Todd impression.
All right, I do have some trivia about this episode. So Mark Kalbfeld's original premise did not involve Alexander at all. Rather, it dealt with a Romulan ship with Federation markings from a future where the Federation and the Romulan Star Empire were supposedly at peace. However, both the ship and the future version of Riker on board would turn out to be hoaxes, part of a ploy by the Romulans. There's an interesting thing when someone comes to, or came to, the producers of Star Trek back in the day. They would listen to pitches all the time. And sometimes they would buy that pitch from you. And if they used that pitch, then you would get screen credit or whatever. And a lot of times they would get a pitch from somebody and they would use that to turn it into something completely different, but they still have to give you screen credit as if you were one of the conceivers of the plot, even though it's nothing like when we talked to Scott, when you and I talked to David Mack,
mm-hmm.
and he talked about the fact that he's credited as being a co-writer on that episode about Nog with his PTSD.
Oh, it's only a paper moon.
Yeah. He's credited as being a writer on that, but he told us, that's nothing like what I wrote. I wrote an episode that was called "Everybody Comes to Quarks," and it was people telling war stories and stuff like that. And it kind of, but it was a springboard for them to come to this. And then they approached him and said, "We wanted to make this." And I was like, "I didn't write this." And, "Yeah, but we got it from what you wrote. So you wrote it." I'm like, okay,
here's a check.
Yeah.
Shut up.
And Sean mentioned just a second ago that the original pitch for this episode would have involved a Romulan ship with Federation markings. And it reminds me, that's the sort of thing that I really would have liked to see on the show, is with playing around with ship designs in that way, to the point where I, just for fun, I think I might have put these on Twitter, but I'm not sure. But in Photoshop, I did a series of ship redesigns, which, it's not like it was all that complex. I would find some high-res pictures of various ships from Star Trek, and then I would change their colorings to make them something else. So I took a Klingon bird of prey, but I adjusted all the color on it to be Cardassian yellow and orange. So what if the Cardassians made a bird of prey? Or what if the Federation made a Romulan warbird. So it's a silver warbird with the blue and red nacelles on the side.
Yeah.
Just doing a lot of palette swaps with different ships. And I had a lot of fun with it. And I kept thinking, I really wish they would try something like that on the show. And in fact, they did something like that in Star Trek Online, where there is an item that you can get that if you apply it to a non-Federation ship, it will change all the colors on that ship to be a Federation design. So you can have a Klingon ship and it will look like the Federation built it, because it'll have all the silvers and an appropriate blues and reds on it. it's a really fun feature. I like flying around
Federation version of the Millennium Falcon that I see online a lot of times. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So that item lets me fly around in Star Trek Online in my Negvar class Klingon cruiser that's all decked out in Federation silver. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, Jerry Taylor recalled, we had bought the story and he wrote it, but it just seemed a little ordinary, so we started messing around with it during one of our brainstorming sessions. And then we hit on the idea that Alexander comes back from the future to kill his young self. That seemed wonderful, but for a long time, that's all we had. We didn't know why he did this. The notion of using Alexander in a time travel plot had originated with an unused premise created by Joe Manosky. Earlier in the season, Manosky had proposed a story where Alexander accidentally fell into a time portal and permanently aged into a bitter 25-year-old man. Michael Piller hated that idea, commented, I think it's hideous to steal somebody's youth from them. John says, I still don't know why he did this. He did it to save Worf from being assassinated in the future. Basically, that's the basic idea there.
I think it's horrible to steal a character's childhood, so we'll do it to Molly because O'Brien must suffer. kid falling through a time portal. That is the DS9 episode.
Isn't being raised with Worf as your father already stealing your childhood?
Ooh.
Thanks.
Now, there is one good thing about this episode, and I credit where credit is due. This is the only time that Worf is a good father to Alexander. And that's when he finally goes, you know what, Alexander, you be you, you do you. And I'm here for you. Let's go get some ice cream.
And, well, a fistful of Data's, he actually plays with his son. They actually go play pretend together.
After dragging him kicking and screaming to the holodeck, yeah. After Worf makes every effort to take on more work so he doesn't have to go spend time with his son.
Yeah, yeah.
And Picard's like, what are you doing? You don't have to... No, stop doing more work. Relax, take time off. And he's like, yes, I guess I have time to go to the holodeck with you.
He doesn't really have a good time until Troy gets there. All right. Although not used here, the plot would eventually be recycled into Deep Space Nine's Time Orphan, the one I was just talking about. The finished episode's plot is similar to the animated series Yesteryear and the science fiction film Back to the Future. Originally, Rene Echeverria wanted to include Kalar as Alexander's rescuer at the end of the of the story. While Susie Plaxton was interested in reprising her character, she declined because she had other acting commitments. He noted, the truth is, it was a blessing. There was enough exposition to explain at the end of the show as it is. Piller noted, I know Rick Berman breathed a sigh of relief because he didn't like the idea in the first place, but for better or worse, that might have helped the episode. So,
as much as I love Susie, and that would have been great to see her on screen again, I think that would have just been one more bad idea in a whole series of bad ideas.
Yeah,
yeah, it would have been a misuse of the character in this episode, which was already not exactly the most well conceived. To make the climax of your episode a heart to heart between a father and his future son,
who doesn't even have the same damn forehead, that pissed me off. Among everything else, I was looking to see if they had even tried to make Kimtar's ridges look the same as Alexander's, just bigger, and they didn't.
Well, yeah, but then you can get into the whole reemergence of those Klingons on Deep Space Nine that didn't even have ridges when they were on the show in the 60s, and now they do. So maybe Klingons' ridges can change over time. I don't know. Maybe they shed them like a turtle sheds a shell or something like that.
The reason that Kang, Kor, and Koloth had ridges in Blood Oath and not in the original series. It's because they had the the corrective cosmetic surgery.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I've heard that theory. But Josh says, I think Christopher Lloyd would have been an interesting choice to play the Joker in Tim Burton's Batman. Oh, sorry, are we still talking about this episode? If we just talked about this episode, this podcast will only be about 20 minutes long.
I don't like this episode. Join us next week.
In the original script, Riker mentions that he had talked to Sisko, and Sisko was the one that suggested that he ask Quark for information on a possible location of the Dura sisters. Armin Shimmerman makes his first appearance as Quark on a Star Trek series other than Deep Space Nine. He later appeared in the Voyager pilot Caretaker, and he filmed a scene for Insurrection that never happened. And we talked about that when we covered that that book that Michael Piller wrote about Insurrection.
Fade to Black.
I could be, because they say that they filmed that scene, but I can't find it online anywhere. You would think that it would have been a DVD extra or something that you could find out there somewhere, but
unless they didn't save it.
Yeah, that's true.
Question.
Since the beginning of time, I have awaited a question.
Do you have IMDb up? Are you reading this from IMDb?
Well, I'm reading it from my notes that I got from IMDb, but I do have it up. What are you looking for?
The guy that they found in the mine. I'd look it up, but my computer runs so slowly when I've got StreamYard running. The guy that they found in the mine when they were looking for Lursa and Betor, was that Max Grodinchik?
Hold on a second.
And I did not go back and rewatch this episode, but I like to think that if I saw Max Grodinchik somewhere, I would know that it was him. He's fairly recognizable, and I'm ready to say 98% no.
I don't think so, but there were also some mannerisms that seemed like it could have been him. So and then I forgot to check before we started.
Max Grodinchik is not listed as being in this episode.
Okay.
So that's probably not. But Susie Plaxton is listed as being in this episode.
Her face is on, her picture is on Alexander's nightstand.
Okay, it does say archive footage and it's uncredited, but prior to this episode, James Sloyan appeared as Aladar Jayrock in The Defector and in Deep Space Nine as Mora Paul in The Alternate, a role he reprised in The Begotten. And
his performance in The Defector was amazing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He also played Dr. Mabor, Jatril, in the Voyager episode, yeah. Jatril. Rick Berman and Michael Piller were hesitant to cast Sloyan as Kimtar, coming as it did so soon after his first appearance as Dr. Mora Paul in The Alternate. However, Jerry Taylor convinced him that the Klingon makeup would hide this fact. She recalled, "I finally went to Michael and I said, look, we can take a lesser actor in this part, or we can cast the actor that we should cast." The episode marks the final appearance of Alexander Roshenko, Lursa, and Betor on the series. The Dura sisters were previously seen in the Star Trek Deep Space Nine episode Past Prologue. They later appeared in Star Trek Generations. Alexander is later seen in Deep Space Nine's sixth season, although he is played by Mark Warden. Writer Ronald D. Moore, who is well known for his Klingon episodes, praised this different take on the major race. He remarked, "The stuff they did in sixth season and Birthright, and then what they did with them here is very interesting. Worf and Alexander celebrate at a Klingon outpost, and they have this sort of mock opera, singing heroic fights and reenactments of things in the streets and banners. And this was a whole different cultural flavor to these guys that I hadn't thought of. My take on Klingons was sort of more Shakespearean with the House of Moog and that kind of stuff, and the rise and fall of political players. Rene brings in a much different element, which I think serves them well." Which is true, but that scene was still boring. Michael Dorn said about this episode, "We don't really know what happens now, just that the future is uncertain. It's just like real life, but Worf is still a terrible father. He hasn't got a clue." Michael Piller commented, I fell in love with the idea of firstborn, which we address the psychological implications of a man who feels like a failure, who comes back to his own youth to destroy himself at a young age in order to avoid the pain that he had caused and the suffering. There is a tremendous science fiction premise in that, and if you have been in any of my therapy, then you know that I've dealt with this on a number of different levels. There's a novel called A Time for War, A Time for Peace, in which Worf recommends Alexander to replace him as Federation ambassador to the Klingon Empire. Worf tells Alexander that when he was young, Worf received a vision of Alexander's future and that it showed him to be an ambassador and excelling at such. Worf does not tell Alexander the source of his vision, but it is stated in the novel that Worf is clearly thinking of the visit from future Alexander that he is referring to as seen in this episode. And in Star Trek Online, in the mission, the house always wins, Alexander sacrifices himself to save Worf's life in the Great Hall, preventing the future that Kimtar had revealed to Worf. So, I guess the story does go full circle in some fashion, if you count Star Trek Online. So,
well, if you count Star Trek Online, then there's a great number of story threads and plot threads from TNG and DS9 that are returned to and explored further. They pick up a lot of threads. They haven't picked up the one TNG thread that I really wish they would follow up on, but there's still time. They're still making new stories.
What TNG thread do you want them to pick up on?
I've long been a proponent of the idea of bringing back Armus from Skin of Evil and exploring the character and the origins of that being further.
I kind of wish Picard had put a torpedo into Armus personally.
It probably wouldn't have been a bad idea, but I think that considering that he is a liquid villain, and he makes vague references to a race of Titans who shed all their negative emotions and, like, you know, evolved and ascended to a higher plane, and all their negativity they left behind in the form of him. Clever writers could find a way to connect that back to the changelings and have Armus be some previously unknown kind of offshoot or splinter of Changeling and develop it from there. And I've long been, it's always seemed to me that, like, it'd be very effective. I was really hoping, I knew it was never going to happen, but when they announced the first season of Picard, I was like, that could be a nice way to end season one, is Picard gets communication from someone. It just simply states, Vagra 2 is empty. Armus has escaped. End season one. That would have brought me back for season two.
I saw a meme a while back that showed they took the title card from Star Trek Picard and they took Picard out and put in Armus, like he was getting his own series to Star Trek Armus. John has a good question here. What was up with the random woman in the background when Quark was making that Zoom call? Because there was a Starfleet officer just standing in the back, and I didn't know if that was because Quark was on an official channel talking to a representative of the Federation, that they had to have somebody associated with the Federation in the room with him to make sure that he didn't do anything terribly unprofessional or whatever. But
I don't know if it was something that official. It was probably more like Riker contacted the station, going through a Starfleet officer saying, hey, I need to talk to your bartender. So a Starfleet officer goes and finds him and says, Quark, you have a call from the USS Enterprise. You can take it in here. And we'll just kind of stand in the back because she's facilitating the call, but I doubt she's monitoring the call.
Yeah, I also thought it was kind of weird because Quark has an office in his bar. He could have just taken the call in there. But they just had, we just need a random dark room for Armin Shimmerman to stand in to take to do this scene. All right. Anybody have anything else they want to add before we close things out?
I hate this episode. So stupid.
And we talked about it way longer than I would have expected for an episode that we don't exactly like. But but yeah, I'm with you. There's plenty to dislike about this episode. A few moments that are nice. I liked Alexander running up to Worf and saying some guy says he's got Mulder's head in a jar. It's like, that's classic, carnival huckster fare right there. Is someone trying to take money from kids and show them a fake head. I liked it. It was... You hesitate to say realistic in this context, but yeah. It made it more real to a degree.
Yeah.
Hashtag Alex ain't that bright.
Alex ain't that bright. All right. Rick, let everybody know where they can find you.
You can find me on the Prime Direction. You can find me on the Open the Iris, which is our Stargate SG-1 show. You can find me on Starbase 66. Yes. and you can find me on this show and on Captain Game Show from time to time. And pretty much a lot of places.
All right. Scott, what about you?
We will hopefully soon be developing and debuting the newest podcast on the Infinite Potato Alliance. I'd Watch That for a Dollar, where I will review not so good and maybe some good movies that I have found exclusively at my local dollar store. Asterisk. Some of them I didn't actually find at the dollar store. Until that show debuts, you can find some of my graphic artwork in various places here on this network in the form of logos, banners, etc. Or you can visit my own art website, www.planetrisecreative.com, or look me up on Twitter at planetrise. Fair warning, neither one have been updated in a while, but there's still stuff there to look at.
Okay. All right. And if you want to find out how you can get a hold of us here on the show, you can go to our website at infinitepotato.com, and you'll find links to our Facebook group, our Twitter page, our YouTube channel, all that kind of stuff. And you can find John on Captain Game Show. The hidden game for season 3 is about to drop its final riddle, which leads to the clues, which if you solve it, leads to glorious prizes.
Glory to you
and your house. All right. So, thank you for joining us. For this episode, make sure you come back in another week or so. We will be back to continue our time travel series, and we will be discussing the Deep Space Nine episode Past Tense.
A transporter accident.
The beam was redirected through time, not space.
Redirected where?
Not where. When?
Sends the crew 3 centuries back in time.
This is not the Earth we're used to, Doctor.
Into the heart of a full-scale revolution.
This place is about to explode.
But getting home may mean rewriting history.
That's enough!
On the next Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Until then, look upon her, look upon death, and always remember...